Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 83, featuring our good friends from No Zone, Tristan Salomé and Mathieu Labo, who are both Belge and have a company in Belgium called No Zone. And they ended up speaking with us at SIGGRAPH, and they were part of V-Ray Days, so I had a chance to do a little podcast with them because I'm sure there's a lot of question about their application called Presence, which now works with V-Ray. So, Stephen...
That was very good French, by the way. I'm always impressed when you break it out.
Because I actually speak French?
Yeah. I think it throws everybody else off, too. They're like, oh, look at Chris.
And look at Chris, in his fancy French accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I know it drives people nuts when I say Bertrand Benoit, because I actually pronounce it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this to you, Bertrand. Anyway, so the other thing that we want to talk about is this Presence application. So what this is interesting about it is that we have been able to do, you know, very, very simply do cube maps, stereo cube maps, which gives you left and right eye views in virtual reality and allows you to rotate your head around and see everything work. But what it doesn't have is... parallax. So explain, if you can, Stephen, in the most simple way, because we will go obviously in depth in it in the podcast, but a simple way, what this Presence thing does, if you can.
Well, I mean, you have a very small volume. Right? Where
you can think of it as a space that you can fit your head in.
As a box around, a box that you're sticking your head in. Mm-hmm. And within those bounds, you can move with, 6 degrees of freedom.
Right. So you can move your head back and forth and see around things, right?
Right?
And I think the default size of that box that they have is 1 meter by 1 meter by half a meter. So it's not teeny.
I think
teeny.
So, right.
It's not teeny.
Half a meter on the height.
Right.
You know, which is kind of, because you don't spend a lot of time, moving your...
up and down.
Yeah.
No, but it's a good sitting down position, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And they're... Everybody always says, oh, it's light field, and they say, no, it's not exactly light field.
Yeah, it's not. And there's a distinction that they make that's very clear.
But the end result is that you get it isn't just side-to-side parallax, right? Like you can move your head around anywhere in that volume, and you're
right.
Going to see it from that, from that viewpoint.
And it's very convincing. It is pre-rendered. It is not a game engine. It's not rendering it on the fly. It is actually rendered out of, in our case, V-Ray. And it looks exactly like what you had originally.
Right.
So it's very cool technology.
And even though it is pre-rendered, they have a novel sort of approach for how they deal with reflections and the specular.
Yeah,
component.
And again, that's not a light field approach, but
right.
It's a novel approach, and it's very effective as well.
Yeah, it's convincing. It doesn't whether it's there's a lot of interpolation going on, but you don't care. It doesn't really.
Yeah,
it's enough. It's enough to really.
Yeah, it's very good.
Convince you. You don't feel.
Yeah.
That there's anything weird about it.
I was very impressed by it. I've been actually talking to them for almost 2 years about this, about us trying to get it in there. And it's been really great that now finally we were able to not only get it going, but announce it and do a podcast about it and everything else. Anyone who wants to check it out, it's available on Steam. So go look up Presence, which is spelled P-R-E-E-N-Z. And check it out and see if you can do it. There's demos in there, and you can go from there. And if you want to be able to work on it, it's in closed beta right now. I'm sure if you contact them at their website, which is Nozone, and you can go to the podcast page, check it out, you can do that too. Only other announcement we have is that a reel is out. So if you go to YouTube and look up Chaos Group TV and check out our latest reel for 2016, it is out. We did it very quickly this year, but had some amazing submissions. I'm very proud of it. Really thanks to Alex Smith, who did music on it, and Brian Miller, who did the editing on it. Looks really, really great. All right, guys, thanks a lot. Hope you enjoyed the podcast.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Thanks so much for coming to our event and talk about this stuff, because this is, as you know, a subject that I've been passionate about for a while. And when I first approached you guys, I was very interested in finding out about your approach to VR and what it means. But before we talk about that, I'm going to do several jumps back and forth in time. Tell me first about NoZone as a company. How long has that been around, and who? How many people are there? What are the roles? What's going on at that company right now?
Okay, so first, Chris, thank you very much for having us.
Yeah.
And but NoZone, it's we founded NoZone in 1998, so now it's 18 years.
Yeah.
And so quite a while ago. And we started like a bunch of independent guys, freelancer in a cave, actually. We were like three.
Uh-huh.
And now we're about, well, usually we're around 20 people. Mm-hmm. And we're working on animated feature film. We go up to 40, 50 people, something like that.
Oh, okay.
So it's really, well, the number of people we are really depends on the load. We're mainly doing high-end commercials and some animated feature films from time to time.
Right. And but you're mainly a VFX content creation place, right?
Yes.
And but at the same time, you have a software division or part of it, right, of some kind.
Actually, we've been doing R&D and mostly plugin and scripts actually development from almost since the beginning.
Okay.
It's in the DNA of the company. We were. Even if we're a small team, I think compared to the size of the company, we're making a lot of internal development, in-house development, much more than other smaller, well, the same size of the company we are. So it's part of our DNA. I think it's linked to Gael and myself, which mm-hmm. are quite into programming, mm-hmm. and we like to try. Sometimes we take the articles from Siggraph and we try to implement that as a plugin. Because if we wait for the big companies usually to implement it, we have to wait like for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of that to get. Shaders for fur to work correctly, mm-hmm. subsurface catering before it was in the software itself, and so on.
Okay.
We have a kind of a great story of plugin and software development in house.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that sounds pretty interesting. And so you said you've been around since 1998. That's a pretty long time. And What brought you guys here is your interest in virtual reality, right?
Yes.
And sort of what you guys have been doing in VR. So tell me, because last time, I mean, I obviously talked to the two of you in an email. It must have been almost 2 years ago, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it was at FMX.
Well, that's the first time I met you guys, but
yeah.
I think we actually
talked a little bit before that, yes.
In an email, right? It was Kim Bauman Larson who got in touch with
exactly,
you.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
And so, so what was his, I mean, how did he find out about you, and like where did this whole thing start? Like when did this VR process start?
Well, it really started, and it started just by reading an article early 2014
mm-hmm.
about let me rewind that a little bit. Actually,
okay.
I was in VR in the 1990s before founding NoZone. Actually.
Right.
Yes.
As was Kim. Actually,
yes.
He was back in Houston. He was trying to do VR for NASA stuff, right? And so that's an interesting thing. So you did a presentation, obviously, and what I liked about it is you had talked about your diverse background, but you started in bioengineering.
Yeah, biochemistry, right. Engineering, right. Yeah, so that was in a different life.
Different life, yeah. Well, we've all had different lives a little bit. But how did VR become a passion of yours?
Okay, so I was making some programs and programming since I'm like 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
My father was an electronic engineer,
uh-huh.
and we bought for a Sinclair, you know, ZX81.
That's the one I had.
Yeah. Okay.
I had a ZX81. Yeah. That was my first computer.
Yeah, it was my first computer as well.
Right.
And then at some point we were lucky and we bought a secondhand Apple II, actually.
Ooh,
which was quite
fancy.
Expensive.
Yeah.
Okay, and well, I was really into those computer, and but not too much into the gaming. I was more actually doing some programs on the computer. So I was buying, I remember the Nimble magazines where you had programs in BASIC you can write down. So I was teaching myself programming actually when, when I was 10 years old. So I, at some point when at the end of my studies of biochemical engineer, there was a possibility to work on artificial intelligence as an end of study program, and it seems interesting to me because I thought, okay, that could be actually mix my computer passion with what I'm doing. So the idea was to try to get my biochemistry knowledge into artificial intelligence, and so I worked after that. I worked at the University of Brussels for 2 years in that, and then I started working for the industry in artificial intelligence, and then I had I was a freelancer and I got quite a lot of free time. So,
but what were you doing in artificial intelligence?
I was actually, it was neural networks. So which are actually coming back.
Deep learning.
Yeah, deep learning.
They call it deep learning now, right?
Yeah, they call it deep learning, yes. It was neural networks at the time. So maybe I'm going, I think, to get back to deep learning at some point as well, because it's, I think there is very interesting stuff to do in vision.
Based on what I saw about deep learning over at GTC for the, what they're doing on the GPU, to me, I have a feeling that deep learning is going to impact absolutely every part of our lives. So VR rendering is going to be impacted by deep learning. So I think that it's going to be an interesting field.
Yeah, that's also interesting. So I think I'm going to, well, there are still a lot of things to do with our presence system, but maybe even deep learning at some point could actually be implemented in some way. So we'll see. But so yeah, I was working in artificial intelligence in neural networks for the industry at the time. And as a freelancer, I had a lot of time left, actually. I was not, it was not a full-time job, but quite well paid. So I started my own project, and was actually augmented reality in the 1990s.
Okay.
So it was one of first one to try to do this kind of stuff.
And what were
stuff.
You using as hardware to augment your reality?
It was a headset called IO glasses, I think, which was partly, you can have it see-through or blocked, low definition. And actually, I was building a kind of tracking system based on infrared lights.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was kind of an inside out. Actually, the camera was on the headset and the infrared lights went on the kind of target. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually play around with the target and have augmented reality objects on the target itself.
Okay.
But through the virtual headset.
Right.
So maybe, well, yeah, maybe not at the right place at the right time. So I was not into the VC funding and so on at the time. So, well, the project at some point stopped, and it was actually developing hardware in your garage is like, it's really a nightmare. So lucky Palmer is, I have all my admiration for that, because I tried that. It's really, really hard. But yeah, so that's the first thing I did in AR actually, and then at some point I met some people in the industry I was working to. It was Tractable, like the engineering part of the power grid guys in Belgium, and there was another group working just next door, which was working on VR and trying to implement VR for to visit like nuclear power plants, like the hot spots in nuclear power plants, and to hear us actually the visit before going there, because there are some places you can go for like 1 or 2 days per year maximum. So the idea was to rehearse that and to be able to get yourself let's say
trained.
Yeah, trained exactly to get yourself there before you could go there. And so that's why I started working on VR. But the problem was the hardware was very crude, and it was the first GeForce card, so the GPUs were not there. So basically everybody was, well, not everybody, but half, more than half of people were sick inside VR. So,
yeah.
So I stopped working in VR.
This was in the 90s, right?
Yeah, 96, 97, something like that.
Okay.
So I stopped working on VR, started working on pre-computed images with NoZone.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2014, so we'll get back to this time, 2014, I just saw a little article, a few lines about Oculus and the Crystal Cove prototype, and that's really what's triggered the whole presence initiative.
Right. So did people know, because I first became aware of the Oculus in 2013 when they first came out, and to me, I had this, you know, the revelation that, you know, you're going to say specifically, I had the revelation that, oh, wow, they made the headset small enough and not clunky enough, and the resolutions of screens are high enough. And really, I think the first one was just like a ski mask with a phone attached to it in black tape, right?
Yep.
Of some kind. But it was still enough to say that that's going to be big now, maybe. Now we should start taking it seriously again. But the problem that one had, which is your specific thing, is that it only had 3 degrees of freedom, right? And those 3 degrees of freedom are just rotation. So it only had a sort of a gyroscope sensor inside of it that would let you know where your head was rotating. And so 2014 was the Crystal Cove. So what was the Crystal Cove that was important to you?
Actually, it was the positional tracking. The fact that the headset not only took into account your head rotation, but also your head position.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, based on my past experience in VR, because the 6 degrees of freedom, let's say, the fact that you take into account the position, was already there in the 1990s as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was mainly using system from magnetic actually sensors, but there were actually 6 degrees of freedom, a bit crude, not very precise, but they were there. But so it was really the mix. Actually, it was the fact that VR was coming back, that they had a wide field of view as well, because the headset in the times had like 35 degrees,
yeah, really,
not 100 degrees.
It's like looking down a tunnel.
Exactly. Yeah. So the field of view was wide. I thought, the GPUs knows already. And they seem to have a very, very nice positional tracking, and they claimed that they had no one sick in VR anymore, and that for me that really was the key.
Right.
Yeah. So that's really triggered me to say, okay, VR is going back this time, and everything is ready this time for
so
VR.
So someone solved the problem that you had.
Yeah.
And then you decided, okay, now a problem is solved. And I can go back to doing what I wanted to
do. Yeah, I can go back to that. There's something interesting with that again. Okay. Let's say. And then, but over like 16 years, I was working in pre-computed images. So
and really, what was your role? What's your role in the company?
Well, it's a small company, so I'm assuming CEO and CTO position at the same time.
Same time. Okay. Yes. All right, and so, but that, then you be, to focus on that. So, how many people, once you decided, okay, we're going to get excited about this, how many people got involved in this project?
Oh, myself.
Yes,
you me, are, myself, honestly. And I.
Yeah.
That's and what
you,
really.
Yeah, and you. And what is your role in the company?
Basically, I'm responsible for the business development. So
right.
So I try to bring my non-nerd approach to the project. Let's
right.
say as a. As basically, my background is completely different. So I have a background in art and business. So
nice.
So I'm not a tech guy.
Uh-huh.
So really, what I like in the technology, it is very intuitive and beautiful at the same time. You
right.
know? So basically, I try to bring the vision of a normal user and what he would like to experience when you are immersed in a movie.
Right.
So. So basically, that's what I found fascinating about the technology first when Tristan brought me in the company, is basically that you are inside the movie. That's a big dream that everybody wanted to have
right.
before, and now it's possible. So that's the beauty of it. You know, it's basically you have enough realism to believe that you are in another world.
Sure.
The quality of the image is there. And then you have the comfort, total comfort, which is very important. It's not a technology for a technology. It's really something that brings like a new experience and a new way of enjoying watching a movie or a story.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And that's basically... So yeah, about the product development, I try to bring this this approach of not being fascinating only by the fact that we accomplish something big technology or technological step, but that's actually useful for
partners who do things and finding out different use cases. I'm sure has been another.
Yeah, of course. Right. And there are plenty of those. You know,
but we'll get to that because I want people to understand what we're doing first.
Of course.
So let's do that. But that's great. Okay, so you're one of the main authors of this thing. You've been doing a lot of the programming. I'm sure you must have other developers that are helping.
Sure. I really like started it just by myself. Just was an idea.
Yeah.
And I had the chance that I had the support from my other partner at Nozone first, and I had the chance that it was in a period where the rest of the company was running all right. So I could actually take like half of my time at first on programming. And trying out and see if my ID was actually working or not.
That's a great company that allows that kind of freedom. So to do that passion project, and this is obviously something that was important to you. So during your presentation, you talked about some of the different challenges. So now I think we can establish, although we can get into more details, that basically 3 degrees of freedom can give you some level of immersion, but the translation is a big part of the feeling that you are there, because that's if you start moving your head back and forth and nothing happens, then it looks like the world is moving with your head, and that can lead to nausea, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
They call it cyber sickness now, I think. So being able to do that is an important part. But then, so you say, okay, so then you started breaking down the different ways that people can try to achieve 6 degrees of freedom in VR. So can you help break that down for people again? I'm just sort of having you go through your presentation.
Yeah, no problem. So the first thing is that it's a 360 normal, let's say, movies, which are just 3 degrees of freedom. Which,
right.
So they are problematic because, well, aside from the fact that they give you some cyber sickness, also your feeling of being there present in the scene is not really there actually in those movies. Mm-hmm. And the other two known technique which are used to bring 6 degrees of freedom are basically the approach which is actually the most used is video game engines. So the idea is you take a real-time game engine, and of course this real-time game engine is not locked to any perspective because it's computing on the fly each images. So it's very good to have a proper immersion feeling. But the problem is that basically you have like 5 milliseconds more or less to compute each image, and compared to the hours we're spending to do proper image in the VFX or and 3D animation industry, of course it's not a lot of time. Even if the GPU helps, actually you feel like you are in a video game. It looks like a video game,
right? Because you have to do it at 90 frames a second, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be crystal rock solid at 90 frames per second to have proper VR. Yes.
Right. Okay. And so there's other challenges to using it in a game engine.
Yes. It's the fact that actually you have to, let's say that if you are already with some content and some software that you know, if you are in the movie industry or in the design industry, basically, you're using other kind of software than the software which are used for real-time games. And also you have to reprocess basically all your assets to crunch them down to actually lower their quality to try to make them fit inside a graphic card.
Right.
So it's time-consuming and it's kind of frustrating for a lot of companies because they have to reduce the quality of their own asset to make it work in VR. So actually that's something we, to be honest, at first when we designed the thing, when we designed Presence, we focused on the idea that, okay, it's going to be great because we're going to have the same image quality and not the same limitation that you have with real-time game engines. And at the same time, we're going to have a perfect immersion. So that's what we were looking after initially.
Right.
And it became very clear quite quickly over time by discussing with the different people interested with the system that one of the main advantages of the system is that you get to keep all your assets and you get to keep all your software. Mm-hmm. And we didn't thought at first that that might be, in a way, maybe the first criteria of choice to our system, mm-hmm. is the fact that you can get all your assets and all your tools. Mm-hmm. We thought it was convenient, but we are experimenting now that it's maybe the major sell factor actually for presence.
It's what we get. That's the feedback we get from people who are reaching to us. It's basically that they are very happy to keep. I mean the way. Their tools and their way of doing things,
right.
And not have to change their team and completely think a different way that they are doing for the moment.
So pipeline stays very close to what they're already used to.
Oh, completely.
And
completely.
Then, and also a level of quality remains what they're used to, right?
That's also a completely.
But it turns out in a way that it's coming in a way the other way around. We were more like thinking, okay, we're going to give a very, very qualitative product, and as a bonus, you get to keep your assets and your pipeline. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the customer are more like, okay, we get to get our assets in our pipeline, and as a bonus, it's a very, very high quality.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I see what you mean. Well, it's so explain specifically, and then there's another one that you mentioned.
As yeah, well, it's a light field.
Light actually. Field. Yeah, right. Explain. Give a definition of light field for those who, if you can imagine it.
Yeah, well, the principle of light field is actually to collect information from every point on the surface of a viewing volume, mm-hmm. to get all the incoming rays from every direction, mm-hmm. at all those points. And from there, actually, you can reconstruct any perspective inside the viewing volume. So that's the principle behind mm-hmm. it. It's absolutely theoretically perfect because you get 6 degrees of freedom inside a pre-recorded light field database, mm-hmm. but the problem is that the quantity of information you have to carry around is enormous, actually. Mm-hmm. So, and also the bandwidth needed to actually play it back is colossal as well. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you have to collect this information. So, collecting it with standard cameras is very, very difficult and bulky, mm-hmm. and if you try to do that with computer generated images, mm-hmm. you have to do tons of renders. So the quantity of computation needed to do that is enormous. Mm-hmm. So that's why the only ones actually doing it are companies which are using GPU accelerated renderings, because they're kind of trying to compensate the fact that there isn't enormous quantity of rendering to do with a very fast renderer.
Sure.
But even with that, it's very, very difficult to do animation right now.
Yeah, it is. It's a challenge. And just, you know, from the, you know, if you think about the news that was released about the what was the camera, the Lytro cinematic camera,
yeah.
It was like 300 gigs of
400 gigs per second. Yes.
Yeah, it's an enormous amount of data, and that's not even a 360 degree image. That's just a standard image based on a camera with a sensor that's half a meter diameter. It's a fascinating field, obviously, the light field, but you know, as you said, right now in its current state, it seems to have an issue in terms of how complicated it could be, or how unwielding the data set can be. But this is also pre-computed information, right?
Yes.
So this is a big distinction that we're making here between the real-time stuff. Real-time is playing live or rendering live while you're doing it, and then the light field, you have to pre-compute it or,
store it
somewhere. Yeah. Enormous amount of information, and also you can either capture that data through whatever camera you're using, or if you're rendering, you have to render that data. And if you have to render that much data, it's a huge amount of rendering to do. So your approach is different, obviously. And explain exactly what you're doing, if you can.
Oh, yeah. Well,
actually, there's some amount that you can't say.
Yeah.
So give an idea of what people are doing.
Absolutely. But the general idea is actually to... so we have some thing which are similar to live fields, so in the sense that we also have a zone of view.
Right.
Yeah. So the idea is that it's also separated the present system is also separated in two phases. So there is a pre-recorded phase, so where we do compute whatever is possible to see within the zone of view, and mm-hmm. we store this information. Mm-hmm. And then after that, at playback time, we reread this information, or the player rereads it, and then takes the 6 degrees of freedom of the tracking of the headset, and then reconstruct, in a way, two images in front of your eyes. Okay. And so the net effect of presence is that you get to have 6 degrees of freedom, so positional tracking, mm-hmm. Inside a pre-computed image.
And that image is not... there's nothing that's a polygon that you're looking at, right? You're looking at pre-rendered information, in a sense, right?
You're looking at a pre-rendered information. Actually, there are some... Our system is a kind of a hybrid approach. So it's not fully image-based as light field. So right. There are actually some geometry in some sense which is in the presence
okay.
file. That's but, not but, really but, represented
but,
at
but
that.
The, but the person doesn't have to necessarily... If I'm a user, right, and I want to create I think we were calling them... volume renders, right?
Yes.
So it's like a volume camera or whatever it is that you're basically saying you define a space, and I think the default that you guys set up right now that you're showing is 1 meter by 1 meter by half a meter,
yes.
right? So you can go 1 meter forward and backwards, 1 meter side to side, and then half a meter up and down.
True.
And then, which is plenty of space for you sitting in a chair and being able to look around and move your head, right?
Yes.
So once that person is in that environment, they render it through your system the way they normally render things, right?
Absolutely.
And then it's processed, I'm assuming, or
yes.
it's processed through your software, and then you can just open it in your viewer and see it as a full...
Absolutely. So the trick is that, first, the rendering time is more or less equivalent to a 4K stereoscopic rendering.
Okay.
So we are far away from the kind of rendering time you will have with light field.
Right.
So it's like 100 times faster than light field
right.
easily. So basically what we are doing is we're messing around with the camera plugin. So usually your camera is just shooting rays in a normal perspective fashion.
Yeah, a single point in space.
Yeah, single point of view, and then you're just... scanning out each pixel of your image mm-hmm. in a standard projection. So that's the principle that we're messing around with that, and we're starting to shoot rays and to decide actually where to shoot rays mm-hmm. From different location and in different directions.
Okay.
And that's one of the main components of the system, is that we're not shooting rays from every point in every direction. It's not a brute force approach. Mm-hmm. We're more like trying to find out from your scene, but all of this purely are automatic. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the presence plugin that does it for you.
Right.
As a user, you just hit render and wait for it.
Right.
But the system actually is trying to find out from where you should shoot rays and in which direction mm-hmm. to actually gather all the information needed to afterwards have a look at the scene.
Okay.
Immersed.
Well, that's so you're able to. So from the user's point of view, which is they're using a special quote-unquote camera,
yeah.
right? And then you see a volume that camera is going to occupy in terms of its transform, right?
Yes.
And then they just render, right?
Yes, absolutely. So actually there is no notion anymore of field of view in the camera. It's more like you just place in the software the volume which will correspond to your view zone.
Okay.
And that's it. And
imagine your head can fit in this box.
Yes.
And that's, you'll see everything around in that area.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the nice thing is that all the rest, well, actually we're talking with the rendering engine, for instance, with V-Ray.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking with V-Ray and we're asking V-Ray, please shoot me a ray in that direction.
Right.
And so as a result, the image quality and the shaders and the lighting, everything stays exactly the same as a standard rendering.
Right.
Because basically everything is the same except the way it's like a new projection
right.
for the camera in a way.
Because I remember when you were talking to me, I guess we mentioned that a couple of years ago, you were saying, it's like, no, this is, you know, we've got this working, we've got it working in Arnold. There's no reason why I can't make it work in other rendering engines. Obviously, you know, we're in the same boat. And like, you want your product to work in any rendering engine
yes.
because artists use
lots of different tools, and they want to be able to give them available and the tools that they have available. And the same thing for us is we want to make sure that our rendering engine is available to any other kind of method of looking at VR. But I thought it was really interesting. It's like, oh, I'll just take your rendering engine and hack it in a way to make it do exactly the type of format that you wanted. And so how has that relationship worked with Chaos Group? Has it worked well for
the
development?
Well, Vlado is very much into the development, as everybody knows.
He answers every question, unfortunately.
That's kind of crazy. Yeah. I don't know where he's sleeping. So the relationship worked very well. And we do really feel on our side that Chaos Group is interested in the present system,
right,
and that we have a lot of support from you to actually make it work.
Well, I think it's, what's interesting for us is that obviously this is a system that I think has a wide range of interest. We have a lot of people that work in visual effects. Obviously, a lot of people in visual effects are interested in VR, and that's great. But one of our biggest customer bases is the architecture field. Mm-hmm. And to me, VR, especially high quality VR, is a huge demand in the architectural field, because the whole nature of VR is to take you to a place that doesn't exist, right? And architecture is exactly that. Like, oh, what is my building going to look like? Here you go. And you have the full immersion, and full quality is really kind of a key thing right there.
And I also think that the headsets are, for me, actually, I don't think they're really expensive. Well, it's $800 is for a Vive, for instance, mm-hmm. is a lot of money for a person, but mm-hmm. like for enterprise or for designer, for architect, mm-hmm. it's really very cheap.
No, actually. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a story. It was 2013 or 14. I don't remember, but I think it was 14. I was at Chicago AIA, and this is when the DK2 maybe just came out, right? Mm-hmm. So this was before Crystal Cove. So I guess it was 2013. I was in the booth, and we're talking to all these architects, right? And they all come by. It's like, oh, what's up with V-Ray? Or what is V-Ray? Because they're architects. They don't always know, right? And then it's like, oh, I know, do this. And we're looking at stuff. I was asking them questions about VR. And it says, oh, yeah, we got a DK2. They all had DK2s in their office. Because at the time, it was $500, right? Yeah. They buy it. But they all put them in. It's like, I don't know what to do with it. They knew this was the future. But they had, they says, oh, how, the only way to me to do something with this is to learn Unity or whatever, and that was back then. Obviously, a lot has changed now. So they're all looking for that opportunity to do something with virtual reality. And now there's actually some really great tools for architecture. But I think specifically, we support, obviously, Cube Maps, right? Stereo Cube Maps, which has been a great success for them, because now they're getting high-quality stuff and they're doing stuff. But if they want to get over that issue of the 6 degrees of freedom, it gets a little tougher, and there's some solutions like you mentioned, but having the super high quality and having the same tools, that's a key to that goal.
Yeah, I think basically what architects like, it's when they it looks exactly the same way that it's going to look in the future.
Yep.
Exactly. So respecting the look of the materials and the light that you will have in a room or in a building, it's really essential for selling what they have to sell. Mm-hmm. So basically, we feel that there is an interest. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, since we started with Presence, we felt that there is a big interest from architects, and companies mm-hmm. are keeping reaching to me for news and see. So guys, we know you're on Arnold, but basically nobody in the architecture is using Arnold. So mm-hmm. that was one of the key points also to work with you guys. Mm-hmm. Basically, you have a lot of users in this market, and mm-hmm. and now since we announced the beta, I see that people were waiting really for Presence to be
right.
to be ported.
I bet you your next question is, when is it available in Max, right?
Soon.
Yeah, because that's going to be another question, and then obviously, and then we actually offer a lot of different plugins for different available. So Max, and then people are going to start asking, when is it available in a Rhino? When is it available in SketchUp?
Yeah, I think Max is going
to
be very soon.
Yeah, Max is going to be the first one. Yeah. And the trick is that actually in Max, we don't need to do a lot of things. We just need to do a plugin that actually presents you the zone of view.
Right.
So it's we're just making a wireframe cube, so it will be quite quick to do.
Nice.
Yes. So basically the hard part, I think we did it, was to, is really to do the implementation on the rendering engine, on V-Ray. That's the hard part. After that, the other plugins on the different on the different 3D package is much faster to do.
We start the so we have a private beta now, and so it's limited to we have a lot of requests, so
do you want to tell people how they get in touch with you about getting on there?
No, you can. I mean, we're gonna make some people wait, of course.
Sure.
Because we are a small team, as we started to say at the beginning of this this podcast, but basically we're gonna start with a Maya beta, and then I think we're gonna switch very very quickly to Max as well.
Okay.
It's just to make it as easy as possible for us to go as fast as possible to a commercialized version as well. So,
okay.
So it's important to feel comfortable as well. We don't have a lot of.
Do you have any news
Max,
on how
guy in the office as well? So that's
right. Yeah. Do you have any ideas of how people are going to be able to buy this? Is it going to be a plugin? Or do you have any news that you can tell people about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so the idea is that the idea will be to have a freemium.
Freemium
monetization scheme. So the idea is that everybody will be able to actually have the plugin, and or maybe the plugin will actually come with the V-Ray package directly.
Yeah, I think we're looking into some being able to do that as well.
So basically, you will be able to do some renderings just like that. But there will be kind of a watermark on the images you're doing. But the trick is that the watermark won't be really embedded in the image. The watermark will be shown by the player if the image is not digitally signed. So you will be able to play around with it as much as you want. The watermark won't prevent you from seeing if the image does fit your need, if it's okay. So you can make as many iterations as you like. And if you do want to use the image in a commercial fashion, then you will de-lock it, and then you will pay actually to de-lock the image you want to use.
Okay.
You won't even need to actually send us the image. We won't see your image. We'll just create a hash of the image, and we digitally sign the hash and give you the sign back, and then the player will see that the image is properly signed and remove the watermark.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So you pay for what you need.
Yeah, exactly. You pay for what you need, and on the meantime, you can test it as much as you like.
Right.
Yeah. Because basically we want it to be tested as much as possible. They don't really know how it's going to be.
Right.
So this is very important for them to first test if it works well, how it looks, if they can actually how the customers are reacting. Is there really an added value and stuff? This is why we choose for this premium model.
And also, it's something that does fit, I think, our commercial relationship with the engine makers as well, because we don't have to carry
to change your price.
Yeah, change the price.
Right.
For example, to have a deal. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Just allows you to put it and get it in the hands of as many people as possible.
Yes, that's
right?
The idea. Yeah.
That makes sense. Well, that's really cool. But I want to go over a couple of technical questions that I'm sure people are going to start to ask. So you mentioned it's a volumetric thing. One of the things that's big about light field, right? The way I like to think of light field, if I'm doing a live or a live action light field or from a camera or whatever, it's almost like live ray tracing, right? Because from every angle, like I'm looking at that glass of water, and from every angle, I'm able to actually see the reflections, and the refractions change as I move my head, right? It's not there. And so reflections and refractions are a complicated solution that obviously needs to be solved. Now, light field does that by its definition, right?
Yes, the hard way.
But it does it by definition. And so you are doing something in order to... There's obviously the, let's call it a compromise, which allows you to render 100 times faster, right? Yes. So what is that compromise and what are you able to do? And can you explain that? Because you explained it in your talk very well. I wanted you to go through that.
Yeah, so actually we developed a system. Actually, it wasn't the first version. We put it a few months after starting, but so we developed a technique which we call the deep reflections, and that allows to actually have a feeling of real depth inside the reflections and inside the transparent objects or the refractive objects. So it's a kind of a trick on your brain, actually, because the reflections are, or the speculars are not really moving based on your position, but they are presented in stereoscopy to your eyes in a way that your brain does accept them and you do feel the reflection at the proper depth.
Okay.
And your brain actually will make you think that they are moving even if they are not completely moving.
So they are kind of, what did you refer to it in the center of the space? It's called the specular.
Yeah, specular point. Yeah.
Specular point. Yeah, so technically speaking, all reflections are stuck to that center camera in a sense.
Yes, it's a bit more complicated than that actually. But let's say that they're coming as if, well, they're computed as if all the as if your eyes or the camera were at just one central point, the specular point.
Right.
Actually, it's for the stereoscopy, it's a bit more complex than that. But it does a trick, and you can even move move a few meters away from the specular point and still have very good results.
Yeah.
But you cannot move at indefinitely. So
no.
Usually it will fit correctly the room scale tracking by 3x3 or 4x4.
Let's get to that in a second. I want to make sure we talk about that.
Sure.
But the idea is that, you know, because I remember the first time I talked to you guys two FMXs ago, and I was looking, it's like, oh, this looks really cool. I can, you know, I definitely, it's very high quality rendering, and it's obviously, and you get 6 degrees of freedom. The other thing we should also mention that when I had saw that is that you can do animations, right?
Yes, yeah, so we can do animations.
We forgot to mention.
We do animation.
So you can basically look around and see animated stuff. So in order to do animation, how big is your file size? It can't be that big, right?
Well, actually, they're a bit...
still cumbersome?
They're still cumbersome. Well, the file size are about 5 to 20 megabytes per frame.
Okay.
All right. Right now, we're doing it a bit in a dull way. We're just actually playing all the frame one after the other.
Uncompressed.
Uncompressed. Right. And there is no temporal compression, right. Let's say. So it brings up usually to 500 megabytes per second. Mm-hmm. The bandwidth you need. So it's kind of a lot of bandwidth, but the good news is that modern computers with modern SSD doesn't have any problem with that.
Right.
So we can actually, we are running from SSDs, and so you don't have any limitation to the timing. Actually, when we first met, I think we were at about 2.5 gigabytes per second the time.
Right.
Yes. So we improved that already quite a lot. Yeah, but not by temporal compression. Actually, it's more spatial compression which has been done because there
but
are.
But it's still on a per frame basis.
Yeah, it's certain per frame basis. Actually, okay. we were at 100 megabytes per frame actually at the time.
Okay.
And so we brought it down to 5 to 20, but we still don't have temporal compression. And but the good news is that there is a lot of temporal redundancy in the files.
Of course, we
know about it. So. When we're going to tackle this temporal compression, and there is a way to do it, then it will bring down the file size for the movies quite a lot, not for the fixed image. But we also implemented another trick, which is actually the player can handle two different layers and actually composite them on the fly.
Okay.
So that allows you to, for instance, load the background layer just once, and then have just the animation of your character, for instance, which will be the foreground layer, and that will actually reduce to maybe a few megabytes per frame,
right?
The quantity of information you're having. So, we have commercial project we did, which were down to 1 gigabyte per minute. Which actually not bad, because when you compare that to the kind of data size for a properly done 360 stereoscopic movie, it's on more or less on the same ballpark.
Right. Yeah. What is the, just so people have an idea, what is the resolution of the image that they're looking at?
It's equivalent to 4K.
It's equivalent to a 4K.
Yes. So actually, there is a resolution factor in the rendering. So, for instance, if you want to do quick tests and quick passes, as you will do for a standard rendering, you can start with low resolution, maybe low anti-aliasing and low sampling, just to see what it looks like, how the space is, and then when you're happy with it, you can then increase the resolution and the sampling.
Sorry. So do people have much control over V-Ray in the sense that, like, today can they, or a lot of the settings locked for your system, such as the anti-aliasing and stuff like that?
Actually, there's just one thing we locked is the minimum sampling. The minimum sampling is kind of locked in production, but actually, if you want to do just non-production, but just test like that, you don't even care to lock it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So. All right. We already established 6 degrees of freedom. You can do animation. You're continuing to work on the bandwidth stuff as well, which is great. Almost, I guess, maybe get to the point where we're streaming this thing.
Well, at some point it will be possible to stream it. I'm pretty sure.
Streaming but will get better as well.
So exactly.
But let's say that the first goal is to try to make it downloadable. We'll be very happy with just downloadable for the moment. But again, for location-based VR, that's not at all a problem.
No.
And even for B2B, usually is not a problem. As I say, that the file size are a bit problematic if you want to have a B2C where people are actually downloading on SteamVR or the latest Oculus Store, the latest movie. Then if it's taking too much of their bandwidth, they won't be very happy about it.
Right.
But for B2B, it's not really a problem. Right.
Mm-hmm. And then, so 2 years ago when I was looking at it and I asked you, I saw, you know, something that was a car or something, and that was, and I said, oh, the reflections are stuck on the car.
Yeah, that's true.
They were stuck on the car, and I was like, oh, and it's like, that's too bad, because I wanted to see those move, right? And if you have a single point, then it doesn't matter because you just have a stereoscopic view. Yeah. But when it was spinning and I could move around, I could see it. And then suddenly, last FMX, I came over to see when you were showing me an image of the car. With a the zebra, the typical zebra stripe lighting that goes on top of it. And I said, wait a minute. I was so excited to see that. Now, I know you're doing some tricks to make that happen, but that I don't care, because one, it's not something that I necessarily have to control that much, right? And also the fact that it's completely believable to me, and that's all that matters in this situation. But is it accurate in a sense, or is it?
It's quite accurate. Well, in a way, it's perfectly accurate from more or less around the specular point. It's perfectly accurate. Then it becomes inaccurate, but still, I mean, it's inaccurate from your current point of view. But it's still a good. The reflection are the proper reflection, which are ray traced, as opposed to trying to just do a fake reflection with an environment ball around your object. So those are real reflections. Yeah. So they're perfectly accurate. Let's say that the further you go away from the specular point, the less accurate they are compared to your point of view, but still they are looking good. Yeah.
Okay, so this brings up the other point that you were talking about. So your default volume, 1 meter by 1 meter by half a meter, but if you want to be able, obviously that works well for we call it the sitting down or VR, right? As opposed to the Vive, where you have a larger space, right? So you have several ways of tackling this. Obviously you can just render a larger volume of some kind, and that would take more time, etc. Or the other thing you do is you just sort of put the volumes next to each other, right? And so when you put the volumes next to each other, and you can basically just seamlessly go from one volume to the next volume. And so basically you can give yourself an area of space. Yeah, is that how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. That's also something we added afterwards. Actually, the thing is that when we developed the system initially, we thought, okay, well, we're going to do immersive movie with this, and mm-hmm. and when the experience is going to be like 20 minutes or more, well, people are going to be sitting down to look at the movie, sure. even if it's an immersive one. But then the Vive headset came, actually, with a room scale tracking, and we also felt that, okay, the fact that we can walk a little bit in VR is really changing things. And there is a lot of content which actually with our system, we think that just one single image actually is something, with one single immersive image is mm-hmm. interesting to see. Mm-hmm. So there will be some people willing to actually walk around. So the idea is that by putting several of those zones of use, those boxes, one next to each other, you can actually achieve a much bigger a bigger general zone of view, and mm-hmm. the trick is that the player allows to transit seamlessly from one box to the other.
Right, and I love the way it looks, in the sense that you see the box if you're outside the volume.
Yeah, that's something we added recently
I
as
love
well.
That.
Yeah,
it's really just it spatially makes sense. It's like, oh look, there's a box, and I can. It's like looking through a time portal, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you see this box, and you're like, oh okay, and then you walk into the box, and as you walk in, then you're completely inside this new environment. And then you even show the example of you could have another box that's not necessarily connected to it on another place, so you can walk out of that volume and then walk into another volume. And I think that's I'm just thinking about it as an architect as well, because those are the people I think I know are going to love this advantage. Especially, it's like, it's real simple. Something I know how to do is like, you put these different volumes, like, okay, you can walk into this room, walk out of the room, go into another room, go out, and just have that idea of what it is, because just seeing that is going to be valuable for them. And it's very intuitive.
It's
weirdly
very
intuitive, right?
Yeah, we had even children in it, and they were really like putting the headset on and directly going to the box and entering. And it's very intuitive, basically.
Yeah.
So... yeah, that's one of the great stuff about it.
Yeah,
it was actually it's at some point it was linked to the point where we started to be on Steam VR, mm-hmm. and we had a lot of people not really understanding how well this boxing, because before we were in an environment where the box was just represented by a wireframe, mm-hmm. so it was a white wireframe box in black space. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were saying, "Okay, well, that's there is a white box. What am I supposed to do?" Mm-hmm. So that's where we started to think about how can we make the interface more intuitive. And at some point, we found out since we can have a look everywhere we like inside the box, it also means that when we are outside the box, we can see through it and mm-hmm. have a proper vision.
Right.
And so we made some tests, and it was really a revelution. I tried at the time to say, wow, this is great, because it's much more intuitive.
Right.
And also the interesting thing is that it also makes the experience fun outside of the box.
It looks cool, because it looks like you're going into a time portal. Yeah. It looks like you're teleporting into a space, but you feel like you're physically going into it. So it's a great idea. It's a great idea.
Yeah, before it was really also breaking the immersion, because it was cutting directly, and you were actually, stop believing it, because the old point is actually to believe that you are somewhere
right.
else. Here it's like you still have an experience outside, and mm-hmm. you don't have this shock of going outside an image. So it's really what we were looking for, and we were really thinking about different approaches, and this is the one we found the best, basically. And we are quite happy about it.
We already had very good return actually on
that.
Great.
So I've heard some people say it's elegant. That's the adjective that they're using.
Yeah, I would say that's a good way to describe it.
Yeah.
It's a very elegant solution for that. Last thing I want to talk about is what you guys, where you guys want to go with this? Where do you want to do with it? Obviously, you mentioned a passion for cinematic, immersive environment experience, movies, whatever. That's obviously a passion. Why is that a passion for you?
I want to have Ready Player One inside it.
You want to have, okay. Yeah, okay. But this is also a pre-recorded information, right? Yes. So this is information where you're not necessarily interacting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I want to have, I really want to have a full AAA movie inside it. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to get there. We're having the proper discussion to get there at some point. Maybe it will. I think, and on the first stage, it will be on location based VR. Just because it doesn't make so much sense for the moment, because there are not enough headsets around which are supporting the system. So
yeah, soon.
It's growing, but let's say compared to the budget of those big movies,
right,
it's difficult to justify it. But if it's a location based VR, mm-hmm, then it will completely make sense. And then at some point, it will be released for the home VR as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we want, actually, is to have, like, yeah, half an hour experience, for instance, mm-hmm, with a proper director, proper animation, something that could be really like a dream come true for me.
Right.
But on the side, I think there are going to be a lot of usage which would be very interesting for architecture, mm-hmm, for interior design, for designers with it. So
art of design.
And I think also artists could find it very interesting as well, because artists doing construction, mm-hmm, they can actually free themselves from all the physics in a way, mm-hmm, and do artistic construction in VR.
I have a friend of mine, his name is Kevin Mack, and he does some incredible procedural VR art that's all based in Houdini, and it's incredible.
We know him. Yeah, he's doing very nice things.
Yeah. I mean, it's very experiential, it's very abstract, and it's really very emotional when you go into these spaces. So that it could be, something else.
We are talking, and it might happen.
Okay. Yeah, I've been trying to help him out as well, trying to figure out the best solutions for him. But
Okay, I guess you wanted also like maybe us to talk about interactivity now, or that's
Do you have ideas for interactivity?
Yes. There's another thing is that the system basically is perfectly able to run with real time graphics, mm-hmm, blended with it.
Oh, inside of it.
Yeah, inside of it. So actually, if you test it on the Vive headset, if you look at your Vive controllers, you can put the Vive controller behind a presence element in the scene, mm-hmm, and it will disappear and be occluded properly. Mm. So it means that you can add a layer of real time object as well. Mm-hmm. So we're looking into that actually, to integrate the presence player as a plugin in a way on some game engines. Mm-hmm. So that will allow you to add some layer of maybe some layer of interactivity with some object we can interact with, but also it would be interesting to see your own body or your own avatar, or also to have more like a social experience, mm-hmm, and being able to see other people watching the same content.
Yeah.
And the avatars of other people watching the same content.
That would be huge. Yeah, avatars are a big thing. I know that Kim is looking at solutions for avatars inside of rooms. And just based on what you just said, that sounds like you would be able to have a fully rendered space and see an avatar of that person in that space. And that person may not, based on the fact that it's a real-time engine, and we mentioned the challenge to that, that person may not be a perfect representation, maybe a low polygon representation or something captured, but at least that person, where they are, where you can talk to them.
Yeah, I think the solution that we see more and more, and that is actually very well working, it's basically represent the person just by a headset or just hands and face.
He was doing a solution, he was showing me something that involved a very quick connect mesh of the person, and it was really it was great. What was weird is he was showing me a avatar of myself, so it was like
you were seeing yourself.
It was an out of body experience. I'm looking at myself. I'm like, whoa, it's not a mirror. It's like it was very strange. It was cool though, but I was it was interesting. But I think they're right, and so it's the fact that you guys basically do have a 3D representation of the space, even though it's a rendered space, yes. It allows for that to happen. That's really cool. So what do you think that some of the future, what are the futures of, like, you know, down the line that you guys are thinking about? That did you, or did you think the VR is going to go that did you want to be involved in?
It's AR basically.
Really?
Well, I won't say that the future of VR is AR.
No. But I mean, like, a part of the experience that no people are experiencing in VR will be in AR in the future.
Yes.
But we are still very. I mean, we like full immersion as well. I mean, the system that we built at the beginning is to actually teleport people into another place.
Yep.
So VR makes sense in this way that you actually go somewhere, you are fully immersed, and you completely forget that you are in a poor gray room, but you feel that you are in another world. Mm-hmm. So VR makes completely sense for that. But we are also looking at AR as a possibility. That's something that we will actually port our system to AR headsets, and we are going to use that as well. And it's going to be huge. AR will be huge. I mean, for B2B applications, of course, and for everyday life. That's something quite obvious, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I think AR will be, there's a lot of projection actually, which concur with that, is that AR will be in the end more used than VR. And because, AR, proper AR, I'm not talking about fiduciary markers with your phone. I mean, AR where you're actually wearing some very light goggles, and that objects which are not really there do appear somewhere, and you have the feeling that they're real. Basically, it's really magic. I mean, it's something that we completely change the way we interact, and we can. I think in the end we might get rid of a lot of our screens because AR allows to have your screens everywhere, every size, and not even screens, 3D object and so on. So I guess it will really revolutionize how we get the information. Mm-hmm. It might be. Well, it's going to be quite weird at the beginning because we will have a lot. Well, you will have people with AR and people without AR. I think at some point, because you will be, if we both have the headset, for instance, we'll be able to share information and to look at stuff which are not there. Mm-hmm. And see if Matthew here is not wearing it or not having it will be quite weird because
I think people will get used to that from I mean their work. It's going to be first at work, at your offices you will wear it. So I think people will get used more and more to that when they will actually work with it, and maybe after they will actually wear it all the time. But I think that's
people
be
are getting used to it all. I mean, just look at the Pokemon thing, right? That's going on right now. People are obsessed about it and talking about, like, oh, you know, Pokemon is bad because all these people are wandering in the streets. Like, these are people that would normally just be in their basement doing a video game. Right now, they're outside doing a video game. And the only that's already improvement. And so Danny should be happy about that. You're just surprised to see these people because you normally wouldn't see them, you know. But it is taking, that's the smallest incremental idea of AR, right? It's amount of it's a representation of a virtual world inside of a real world experience that allows you to do that. And I don't know, my son and I are enjoying it. It was funny. Like, my son was hanging out at my wife's work the other day, and someone came out. I was like, "What are you doing? You're hunting for Pokemon?" So that just became a thing. So it's kind of funny. All right, so. I think that augmented reality definitely has a strong sense of future, and there's a lot of social implications, which were, just on based on what we just said with Pokemon, it's only starting to scratch the surface, absolutely. Right?
Yeah.
But VR is going to be much more a closed idea, yes. Right? You are going to be, VR, I mean, you can even go to a trade show here, and you know that it's a completely personal experience. And that's the problem with it, in a sense, at a trade show. that one person at a time can experience this thing. And so there's always the longest line possible of people trying to experience the thing. You can't, it's not like going to a movie theater.
No, we are looking at, I mean, like, this is a strong limitation. We are looking also at ways to be able to share your experience. To actually kind of be able to share a movie or yourself in a movie on social medias. And that's some stuff we are also like developing.
Right.
So that's going to come soon.
I think the key, I think one of the big things, I think we mentioned it before, is a way for two people, both in VR, to experience the thing at the same time, where they know where the other person is. They can. There is a level of interactivity.
Yeah, not to be alone in VR. I think it's as you will go for a movie. Usually, well, you could say that when the theater is black, you just watch the movie, but you do feel actually some reaction of your wife or whoever is at the movie with you. So it's interesting. I think it's to actually be able to see where the other person in next to you is looking at, and to have this presence of someone else. I think it's a key factor also. Yeah.
A good horror film is better in a movie theater when everyone freaks out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of it.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, that's been great. We were actually perfect time. Is there any other big announcement? Let's get the people an idea. If they want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to get in touch with you guys?
Through Mathieu. Yeah, there is my contact on our website, so you can just.
So we'll put your website up on the podcast page.
Yeah, and very very important. Basically, our player is on Steam VR. So if people want to experience,
And you have some samples up there that people can look at.
Yeah.
Including the rewind ones.
It's very soon, next week or something. Great. We're going to put them there. So
it's available for both right now. Which rendering engines do you support? You support Arnold, obviously, and you support V-Ray as well now, or V-Ray's in beta. Is there other ones you're supporting as well at this point? You're thinking about?
Actually, the idea we're having right now is more to, now we're going to spend some time making a kind of SDK of our own system to let other people actually make the port in their rendering engine.
Oh, nice.
That idea came because a lot of big companies actually, big VFX company or animation company, do have their own rendering engine. So it's becoming difficult to actually make the port for them.
Yeah.
And sometimes also they don't want really you to be poking around their code and so on. So
you swapped it now instead of getting our SDK.
SDK. Yeah, the idea is to swap it, to turn it around. And I think from the experience we have now with Arnold and V-Ray, I think we can build something which could be working for a lot of the other renderers.
Great.
So yeah, I think we're going to inverse actually that, and we're already talking with big VFX and animation companies, and they really like this approach to that we gave them an SDK, and with an example how to do a plugin with the SDK, and they will do the plugin themselves in their rendering engine.
But it's available in V-Ray now, so a lot of our people who are it's going to be available. It's in closed beta.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you're going to have an open beta.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the idea. So closed beta for beta. Several, let's say, months.
Yeah, we would.
Depend how we will go. Yeah, I mean,
we hope to have something by the. I mean, like a commercial version by the end of the year.
Do you have a commercial version now of all of it? So can no, you don't. No, right. No, you guys are still like closed beta, right?
Yeah.
Gotcha. But I love your pricing ideas. I love how that works. That's a really cool way of working. I'm sure you guys will announce the price of the unlocking an image at some point. That's something
trying to figure out the good price. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You'll have it available in Max soon, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So that sounds great. I really appreciate you guys. The presentation yesterday was very clear. I think it was really cool for a lot of people to see that. And I'm sure they'll be getting a lot of questions for you guys.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.